from deep inside your radio.
And the pace ever quickens. Ladies and gentlemen, the story really died here in the United States moments after it was revealed that our first detainee at Guantanamo to come to trial, I said trial, to come before a military tribunal, pled guilty and was sentenced to 9 months. The first guy up in line at Guantanamo. Now, does that mean he's the worst of the worst, the guiltiest guy, the worst, the most threatening? Or does it mean Australian Prime Minister John Howard was having a problem with his election campaign this year with the Australian detainee, David Hicks, number one in line at Guantanamo, and wanted him back in Australia ASAP? I asked, just asking the question. But, you'd think that the first guy to go through this new system at Guantanamo would gain a little more attention on the American media scene. After all, Anna Nicole's still dead. Especially when he signs this plea agreement that, among other things, gags him, gags anybody he talks to, gags his lawyer for a year after he returns to Australia, meaning the Australian election would be over before David Hicks can say what really happened at Guantanamo. We have some indication, however. Australian Guantanamo detainee David Hicks feared he would be shot unless he cooperated with U.S. interrogators in Afghanistan. That, according to a sworn statement by Hicks presented to a British court. In the affidavit, Hicks said he was slapped, kicked, punched, and spat on after being arrested by coalition forces in Afghanistan in 2001. He said he heard other detainees screaming in pain, had seen evidence of beatings, and had a shotgun trained on him during questioning. Well, that's almost as bad as what the Iranians did to the Brits. Quote, I realized that if I did not cooperate with U.S. interrogators, I might be shot, he said in the document handed to British authorities, obtained this week by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. A different ABC. A different breed of ABC. The affidavit detailed the allegations of mistreatment as part of his unsuccessful bid to obtain British citizenship last year. Okay. So he signed something saying that to get to be a citizen of Britain, which was denied. And he said something else, that he forswore any allegations of mistreatment in order to get out of Guantanamo. Believe either of them? Hicks said he was twice in the British affidavit, he said he was twice taken off a U.S. warship, flown to an unknown location, and physically abused by U.S. personnel for a total of 16 hours. Two U.S. investigations of the claim said it was unfounded. He spent more than 5 years in Guantanamo Bay without being charged, finally pled guilty to a charge of offending a law, giving material support to terrorism, that hadn't been passed until he'd been in jail for 4 years. Yeah, I know. That's the Constitution. What are you thinking? In the affidavit, he said he felt at risk of physical abuse and he'd seen one prisoner set upon by dogs and another have his head slammed into concrete until he was unconscious. By early 2003, he says in the affidavit, he felt, quote, I had to ensure that whatever I did pleased the interrogators to keep from being physically abused, placed in isolation, and remaining at Guantanamo for the rest of my life. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Colin Powell, said the claims were credible. Quote, I know this kind of abuse happened. I've talked to people who participated in it, says the former chief of staff to former Secretary of State Powell. Quote, I've talked to people who participated in it, CIA, military, and contractor. Wilkerson added, military officers had told him the interrogations at Guantanamo had revealed, quote, virtually nothing that resembled useful intelligence. But the beatings were fun. You know, you have that, you have those memories. Also, ladies and gentlemen, on the national security front, the United States and Britain have been demanding that you take no more than 3 ounces of a liquid or a gel down up from zero. Because what? The terrorists changed their plans since last August. Guess where you didn't have to limit your carry-on to 3 ounces of liquid or gel until this week? Australia. They just instituted the new anti-terrorism measures this week in response to that, quote, foiled terrorist plot, quote, in London last year. Things move smoothly because they waited. I don't know. Was Australia in danger until now? And, ladies and gentlemen, finally, before we begin, I know we're 5 minutes into the show and I have the nerve to say that. For those who think that nothing good came of the incident in which Iranians captured 15 British sailors and Marines and held them for 2 weeks before releasing them this week, for those who think that nothing good came out of this incident, I present here with a segment of an interview the BBC had this very morning with John Bolton, our former UN ambassador, whom the BBC introduced as a guy who, while he's no longer UN ambassador, often says in public what administration officials are saying in private. No. So no. So very no. Here's John Bolton now.
So I do think the issue is larger than simply the hostage taking itself. It ties in with Iran's efforts to acquire nuclear weapons, to finance terrorists, and to destabilize Iraq. So I'm afraid that the lesson that the Iranians draw from the British reaction is a lesson of weakness, and I do think that will factor into their calculations on these broader fronts as well.
Is that exacerbated by what we're told by the Royal Navy, that it's no longer in a position to be able to board ships in the Northern Gulf because it's lost its boarding boats to the Iranians?
Are you saying they only had two boats?
That's what they tell us.
Well, I'm speechless.
To render John Bolton speechless, ladies and gentlemen, that's a plus. Hello, welcome to the show. He did utter the words regime change after that, but I don't think that counts.
When it's gray in L.A., I sure like it that way, 'cause there's way too much sunshine around here. I don't know about you, I get so sick of blue skies wherever they always appear. And I sure love the sound of the rain pouring down on my carport roof made out of tin. If there's a flood, then there's gonna be mudslides. We all have to pay for our sin. And I suppose it'll close canyon roads and the freeways will all start to clog. And the waters will rise and you won't be surprised when your whole house smells like a wet dog. When it's gray in L.A., it's much better that way. It reminds you that this town's so cool. This whole town's a dump. We came out here to dump all our dreams of making it big, but we're stuck in a singular nightmare. That's just how it seems. And I suppose Lori David sure knows all those cars we drive heat up our earth and sea temperatures rise. Brush fires can sure curb your mirth. Red grease in L.A., yeah, okay, I should stay here. There's no place that's better, I know, for a wannabe star stuck way too much sunshine around here. I don't know about you, I get so sick of blue skies wherever they always appear.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, where we could use some sun right about now, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the show. The gray is getting to me, and it would be getting to me worse if I hadn't, on returning from New York City this week, been riding to the airport on Thursday morning. They blur. And noticed what it was doing outside first week in April. It was snowing, yes, indeed. But now... Just a couple, just to prove that no matter who buys the Los Angeles dog trainer, don't let the reporters do the bookkeeping. Don't let the editors do the bookkeeping. Don't let them do the math, because the Regarding Media column in Tuesday's calendar section said the Los Angeles Times had been sold twice in 5 years. The paper has been sold twice in 7 years. And... oh, there was another one. I've lost it. Okay, well, there was only one then. Trust me, there was another one that got the math wrong, too. But, you know, the paperwork around here, the paperwork, it's radio. What happened to the paperless radio show? I'll tell you what. It's time for me to read the trades for you, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm going to do. First of all, the patron slapped by industry group for sexy ad imagery. Or sorry, that's Patron Tequila. And I'll read it for you. I'll pronounce it correctly. It's a mess today, isn't it? And it's only going to get worse. Dateline Chicago. Perhaps the hottest spirits brand going right now, Patron Tequila, is being slapped by the spirit industry's governing body for using sex to surge its sales. Another surge. The Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. released its semi-annual marketing code report this week, in which it disclosed the outcome of its reviews of every marketing complaint it received during the second half of last year. The industry's good behavior in recent years has helped it gain access to cable TV and other channels that were traditionally closed to liquor advertisers. Patron, which saw its sales double last year, was the report's most complained against advertiser, drawing complaints for three different ads, and in each case having the complaints against it validated. Two of the three complaints centered on the distiller's Simply Perfect ad campaign, which pointed out that some types of perfection are debatable, but others, such as Patron, are not. In one of the ads, a couple lay in bed over the man's head. A caption read, quote, the perfect girl over the woman's head. The caption read, quote, the perfect one-night stand, unquote. Said the Distilled Spirits Council, quote, after careful deliberation, the depiction of a man and a woman in bed with an open bottle of tequila at the foot of the bed and clothes and undergarments strewn on the floor in front of the bed linked the consumption of alcohol to sexual prowess, unquote. Oh, to have been at the deliberations. Patron immediately withdrew the ad, even though it's not a member of the organization. It also withdrew another Simply Perfect ad, which showed two women in a nightclub setting, caption, battery-operated and the real thing, after the board ruled the ad connoted overt sexual activity. Doesn't report that it needed careful deliberation. Patron received a third citation along with Hennessy Very Special Cognac for advertising in the newsstand edition of Spin magazine that did not meet the industry standards of having an audience of at least 70% drinking age readers. But not all the cited marketers were as compliant, reports Advertising Age. A non-member of the council is Bong Vodka. The makers of Bong Vodka ignored the group after the council took issue with the brand's water pipe-shaped bottle. The marketer argued that the packaging was, quote, pop icon imagery, unquote, dating back 100 years to the vodka's Dutch roots. But the council disagreed. Quote, the marketing of a distilled spirit in a bottle shaped as a bong, which is a device commonly known to be used to smoke marijuana in conjunction with using the word bong in the brand name, implies illegal activity. A firm grasp on the obvious, ladies and gentlemen, demonstrated by the Distilled Spirits Council. Brought to the fore when I read the trades for you. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. How are things going in the new Iraq? You might well ask. Well, John McCain has his point of view. We'll get to that later. But according to the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, America's high-security prisons in Iraq have become, quote, terrorist academies, unquote, for the most dangerous militant groups, according to former inmates and Iraqi government officials. Inmates are left largely to run their blocks, which are segregated along sectarian lines. The policy has created a closed world run by Iraq's worst terrorists and militias, into which detainees with no links to insurgent groups are often thrown. Inmates from Camp Cropper. Yes, we named it that. The U.S. prison at Baghdad Airport described at the time seeing al-Qaeda terrorists club to death a man suspected of being an informer. Others dished out retribution with razor wire stolen from the fences. Captain Philip Vincent, a U.S. officer responsible for prisons, said he knew of at least three cases of prisoners being murdered by inmates. Quote, we are very concerned about insurgent efforts to recruit and convert detainees, he said. U.S. officials are investigating the suspicious death of another Camp Cropper inmate. Yes, he came. Said the Iraqi Human Rights Ministry's official for prisons, Saad Sultan, quote, it looks like a terrorist academy. There's a huge number of these students. They study how they can kill, and we protect them and feed them and give them medical care. And the Americans have no solution to this problem, unquote. Vying factions often feed fake tips about their enemies to U.S. forces, meaning just about anyone can end up in jail. U.S. military is scrupulous about separating Sunnis from Shia, but they pay less attention to keeping seasoned terrorists apart from people picked up in security sweeps. Terrorist academies were running over there, ladies and gentlemen, according to the Times of London. And also on the subject of the new Iraq, the 2007 Worldwide Quality of Living Survey by Mercer Human Resource Consulting, whoever they are, has found that four of the world's top five scoring cities for health and sanitation are in North America. Calgary ranks first, Honolulu, Helsinki, Ottawa, and Minneapolis. Calgary scores highest for health and sanitation. Baku in Azerbaijan scores lowest. Zurich scores highest for overall quality of living. Guess which city ranks lowest for overall quality of living? Baghdad. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. XM Satellite Radio, on which this program is heard, is dedicating a channel to Larry King, April 16th through April 20th, celebrating Larry King's 50 years in broadcasting. There'll be clips and interviews from throughout. He gets a channel. Larry's getting his own channel for 5 days. Doesn't say what the channel was before then or what it's going to be after that, but Larry's getting his own channel. So we'll be celebrating along with him. We'll be eating some garlic, raising a head of garlic in a toast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, coming back strong, Tales of Airport Security. I'm feeling good about this week's show. I haven't made a mistake in 5 minutes. For those of you who blanched at Keith Richards' reported quote this week that he had mixed some of his father's cremated remains along with cocaine and snorted them, which his people later said he was joking. I offer you this tale of airport security from Colleen in Pennsylvania. Dear Harry, upon arrival in Fort Lauderdale from Philadelphia in March, I opened my checked suitcase and found the notice that my bag had been inspected. Their curiosity had been piqued by the unmarked tin containing my recently deceased father's cremains. The tin was dented and emphatically triple taped with official TSA adhesive, and the previously sealed plastic bag inside had been opened and hastily twisted closed. I wonder what means they used to determine that my father was not a threat to airline security. Was he chemically tested, sniffed, or did someone taste him? I have a photo of the taped can if you want it. Won't be happening in Australia for another year. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, the copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, the inspectors general, I'll get that right one of these days, have been busy this week, as usual. First of all, federal environmental staff overseeing the cleanup of Ford's toxic waste dump have not exhibited racism toward the dump's Native American neighbors, but they hardly involved them as they should have. That's the gist of a report by the EPA's Inspector General, continuing to assess the environmental agency's conduct in a botched Superfund cleanup in Upper Ringwood, New Jersey's old iron mining area. After an initial cleanup, the government in 1994 declared the site clear of dumping by Ford Motor Company contractors, but since then, residents of the mostly Ramapo Mountain Indian neighborhood reported widespread disease and death. A cleanup resumed in 2004 found thousands of tons of lead-based paint sludge that had been left behind. The inspector general looked into whether the EPA violated environmental justice standards of treating residents near hazardous waste sites in an even-handed manner. All right, the 5 minutes is up. It found no discrimination, but it did find a lack of communication with residents that the EPA must correct. NASA's inspector general routinely tipped off department officials to internal investigations, and at least one case quashed a report related to the Columbia shuttle explosion to avoid embarrassing the agency. This in a 1,000-page report by the Integrity Committee. Did you know we had that? Man, where have they been? The Integrity Committee is a government board that investigates inspectors general. The Integrity Committee, ladies and gentlemen. I want to be on that. They found that Robert Cobb, the inspector general at NASA, created an appearance of a lack of independence and said that NASA did not plan to do enough to discipline him. NASA's administrator has proposed sending him to leadership training and require he meet regularly with department officials on how to improve. But that's not enough, says James Burris, chairman of the Integrity Committee. All members of the committee believe that disciplinary action up to and including removal could be appropriate. The previously unreleased report by the Integrity Committee also faulted Inspector General Cobb for abusing his authority to create at NASA a, quote, an abusive work environment. The Integrity Committee. Now they tell us. The government has reported the Internal Revenue Service lost 490 computers between 2003 and 2006 and is not adequately protecting sensitive taxpayer information, that according to the Treasury Department's Inspector General. The IRS is not only losing hundreds of computers, but is failing to encrypt data and is using weak passwords.
Weak passwords? My password is go ahead, take everything.
And finally, captured Iraqi documents and intelligence interrogations of Saddam Hussein and two former aides all confirmed that Hussein's regime was not directly cooperating with al-Qaeda before the U.S. invasion. That, according to a declassified Defense Department report released this week by Acting Inspector General Tom Gimbel. It also contains new details about the intelligence community's pre-war consensus that the Iraqi government and al-Qaeda had only limited contacts and that reports of deeper links were based on dubious or unconfirmed information. This came on the same day that Vice President Cheney, appearing on Rush Limbaugh's program, repeated his allegation that al-Qaeda was operating inside Iraq. The report, in a passage previously marked secret, said then Undersecretary Doug Feith had asserted in a briefing given to Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, in September 2002, that the relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda was, quote, mature and symbiotic. The inspector general has concluded that Feith's office had inappropriately written intelligence assessments before the invasion. The report says the CIA concluded in June 2002 there were few substantiated contacts between al-Qaeda operatives and Iraqi officials, and it lacked evidence of a long-term relationship like the ones Iraq had forged with other terrorist groups. Overall, the reporting provides no conclusive signs of cooperation on specific terrorist operations, the CIA report said, adding that discussions on the issue were, quote, necessarily speculative. CIA had separately concluded that reports of Iraqi training on weapons of mass destruction were, quote, episodic, sketchy, or not corroborated in other channels, the inspector general said. It said a 2002 CIA report described Iraq and al-Qaeda's relationship as, quote, two organizations trying to feel out or exploit each other rather than cooperating operationally. The CIA was not alone, says the defense IG. The Defense Intelligence Agency had concluded that year that available reporting is, quote, not firm enough to demonstrate an ongoing relationship, unquote, between the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda. The contrary conclusions reached by Feith's office and leaked to the conservative Weekly Standard, owned by Rupert Murdoch before the war, were publicly praised by Cheney as the best source of information on the topic. A circumstance the Pentagon report cites in documenting the impact of what it described as, quote, inappropriate work. Feith's successor has written a 52-page rebuttal to the Inspector General's report. But Feith turned out to be wrong. Doesn't stop him. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, we have to get rid of these inspectors general, don't you know? Because when they're not acting inappropriately and being rebuked by the Integrity Committee, they sometimes tell us what we need to know. And who else is going to do that?
I was walking down Broadway, just doing some window shopping. I saw something before my eyes. My whole jaw was dropping. She had long blonde hair hanging down her waist. Oh, that girl got a beautiful face. The girl could knock anybody out. I tell you there's no doubt. She may be white, but she be funky. The girl be so funky, y'all. When I was a young man, I was told to know my place. Why ain't I part of the human race? She had long blonde hair hanging down to her waist. Oh, that girl got a beautiful face. The girl will knock anybody out. I tell you there's no doubt. She may be white, but she be funky. Oh, the girl be so funky, y'all. Guess I'll be moving on. Just put her out of my mind. And who knows, everybody, maybe some other time. She had long blonde hair hanging down to her waist. Oh, that girl got a beautiful face. I tell you, boys, the girl is mean. Oh, she's a beauty queen. She may be white, but she be funky. Oh, the girl be so funky. I don't know what to do. Oh, I wish I knew. She may be white, but she be funky. Oh, the girl be so funky, y'all. I tell you, boy.
This is Le Show, and you may have noticed this week, ladies and gentlemen, the profusion, the plethora of reporting on the fundraising reports of the various presidential candidates, the plethora of reporting and commentating, about the significance of the various fundraising results. Hillary got $26 million. Obama got $25 million. Ooh, Obama was surprising. He beat expectations. Ooh, McCain didn't come up to expectations. What does this tell us? Are we focusing too much on this? Blah, blah, blah. The one point, to my ears and eyes, never mentioned in all this plethora, of reporting and commentating on candidates' fundraising, is what's the lion's share of the $26 million, the $25 million, McCain's $12 million? What is that lion's share of that money going to do, to pay for? It's going to buy advertising time on television? All the people on television bemoaning or concentrating on the importance of money in politics just seem to leave out what the money's being raised in order to spend it on, you see. Just a fact. And in the old days, broadcasters used to have to sell time for political advertisements at their lowest rate. They don't have to do that anymore. It's a major profit center for broadcasters and cable companies these days, political advertising. So, of course, they bemoan the importance of money in politics. They bemoan it all the way to the bank. Ladies and gentlemen, a book is coming out by historian Robert Dalek about the relationship between former President Nixon and his former National Security Advisor and later former Secretary of State as well, Henry Kissinger. The excerpts have been made public this week. According to them, Nixon called Kissinger, quote, my Jew boy, unquote, behind his back and occasionally to his face as a way to humiliate him and keep him in his place. Kissinger reciprocated. He despised Nixon's top aides, quote, I've never met such a gang of self-seeking bastards in my life, Kissinger told the British ambassador. These people are real heels, he said. I used to find the Kennedy group unattractively narcissistic, but they were idealists. These people, he was referring to Nixon's staff, are real heels. Kissinger privately referred to Nixon as, quote, that madman, quote, our drunken friend, and, quote, the meatball mind. Having read The Will to Live, a book written by Arnold Hutschnecker, his former psychotherapist, who knew, Nixon recommended it to Haldeman as providing a roadmap to what Nixon called K's, Kissinger's, suicidal complex. He also wants to make sure I make extensive memoranda about K's mental processes and so on, Haldeman wrote to his own diary. Apropos of a war we're in at the moment, Kissinger and Nixon very quickly came to private conclusions about Vietnam that they never revealed publicly and denied entertaining. Quote, in Saigon, the tendency is to fight the war to victory, Nixon told Kissinger, according to the transcript of a 1969 phone conversation, continuing to quote, but you and I know it won't happen. It is impossible, unquote. Even so, Nixon later urged the Democratic critics making this same point should be labeled, quote, the party of surrender, unquote. Thank God we're not repeating that history. When someone told Kissinger that Nixon could not be reelected because of Vietnam, Kissinger disputed it and added, according to a memo of a conversation, that, quote, anytime we want to get out of Vietnam, we can, and we will get out of Vietnam before the 72 election. Kissinger advocated a pullout in the fall of 72, according to Haldeman's diary, so that if any bad results follow, they will be too late to affect the election. Thank God we're not politicizing this. And as Kissinger prepared to travel to the Middle East in November of 1973 in the wake of the Yom Kippur War, he wanted his deputies, Alexander Haig and Brent Scowcroft, to assure him that, quote, Nixon was under control. Specifically, he worried that the Soviet ambassador might get in to see Nixon and extract unwise commitments. It is essential, says Nixon, says Kissinger to Scowcroft in a telephone call, that they don't get anything I didn't give them. Kissinger had an aide listening to all his telephone conversations, making verbatim transcripts, by the way. That's where all this stuff comes from. So, would there be any kind of reaction to this? I don't know. Upstairs that might be taped and sent down here for our edification.
And of course, Fred Fielding, still sorting out deep plop at the White House.
Yeah, well.
Sort of ironic.
Not ironic at all. we gave him a start.
No, I know, but ending up as the White House counsel after being assistant White House counsel almost... What, 40 years ago?
Yeah. You're saying slow career path?
Well, I'm saying not much career arc.
Well, of course, he worked for Dane. Yeah. Yeah. That would slow anybody down.
No, I know, but...
You know, you apply for a job at some big New York law firm, you know, kind of hit out at after California. Yeah. And the application comes in, and they see Dean's name on it.
No, they recoil.
Well, they just, you know, they just...
They reject you.
Well, they turn you down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
You think that's still true? I mean,
well, of course, It's been a long time, but...
At this point, you know, half the people in the country probably think John Dean was the movie star who rode motorcycles.
Yeah, but, you know, when you sabotage a whole administration...
No, I know.
And the chances for a whole generation of peace in the Middle East...
Of course, Henry took care of that.
What?
Speaking of Henry, he sees transcripts that come out in a book.
His what now?
His transcripts. And an aide listening in on his phone conversations and writing verbatim transcripts. They're out.
Well,
I mean,
didn't anybody burn anything? What the hell is wrong with people?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we wanted it to all hang out, you know, we would have just given it to Walter Cronkite and been done with it. I mean...
Obviously, he didn't burn the transcript.
No, but I mean...
Because...
That's so much easier to burn than tapes. Yeah. I mean, it's just paper. You don't have to deal with all those little plastic round things.
Mm-hmm. The reels?
That's right. Yep, The reels.
Yeah.
The damn reels.
Well...
Of course the tape will burn, but, you know, the damn reels would just have melted. Isn't that what that expert you found told us?
Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, not very complimentary, Henry, but we knew that.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, but, you know, that's the gratitude you expect when you give a break to a Jew, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, a great old waspy a-hole like Bill Rogers, you know,
mm-hmm.
he was just glad to have the job,
sure.
glad to have the big office, not Henry.
No.
Henry's got to have his job, and he's got to have Bill Rogers' job.
And your job.
That's right. At my job.
I mean, he talks about making the decisions during the Yom Kippur War.
No, I know. Just dragging me to the White House for the photo ops.
Yeah.
I know the deal. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah.
Of course, I never could quite decide whether Henry was, in on the break-in.
Well, that's not really a credible...
No, I mean, think about it, you know. He thinks he's so much smarter than me. You know, he's got his fine Jew brain, you know. So why shouldn't he just... damage me mortally so that he can run the show.
Really think even Henry could war game the way it all actually played out. I don't think Henry could have predicted Dean, for example.
Screw Dean. What do we know about Henry?
You want to try getting the transcripts burned now?
You mean after they've been published?
Well,
burn them after everybody knows what's in them, because if that's really what you're suggesting,
no.
Alderman, you know, I could just...
No.
I could just find another cloud, you know.
Yeah.
Plenty of clouds up here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing these people don't seem to have any shortage of, clouds in those goddamn hearts.
No, I'm just...
You know, it's like going to Raid Ellsberg's shrink's office, mm-hmm. you know, after he's leaked the Pentagon Papers. I mean, you know, why bother? See, damage is done.
Yeah. I think that was your idea.
Well,
anyway, Henry is pretty brutal. He talks about... trying to keep you away from talking with foreign leaders because you'd apparently been drinking. I mean, that was after I was gone, so...
Well, of course I was drinking, you know. A, you were gone.
Mm-hmm.
B, Ehrlichman was gone.
Sure.
C, they didn't have the alcohol drip set up like they do here.
No.
How the hell else is a person supposed to get...
It just seems so petty and personal, so...
So Jewish. That's exactly what I was thinking. So look, obviously this isn't something we leave to the Cubans.
What is it?
Dealing with Henry.
Mm.
John Mitchell's up here, right?
Don't think so.
We didn't get him in with us?
Oh, no, definitely not with us. You said you thought he'd hurt your chances. And...
See, what we need to do is play on Henry's ego, his damn vanity.
Mm-hmm.
See, you remember he was always playing around with those starlets?
Oh, sure. Dating Jill St. John?
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
Henry ends a meeting early to go on a date with Jill St. John. See, I go upstairs. Pat's waiting for me.
Yeah. What was his famous quote? Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac?
Yep. That's right. Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Yeah. I guess we got the wrong dose.
See, so we find out just how sexy old Henry is feeling. Nowadays he's wrinkled up as a dress shirt and yesterday's laundry basket, see?
How do you mean?
We need to get a Jill St. John type to hustle him up. You know, get the old Jew in bed, start the humping. See if it can't induce, you know,
a coronary episode?
I mean, what is he now? Close to 80?
Yeah.
Probably hasn't had a good piece of starlet in a couple of decades.
Well, he hasn't been in power.
No, that's right. Of course. I mean, who's going to trust him after the way he stabbed me in the back?
Mm-hmm. Telling people you were depressed?
Well, no. What was I supposed to dance the hula all day? Of course I was depressed,
yeah.
But, you know, I wasn't depressed the way he meant it.
No.
I mean, he meant it the way Jews get depressed.
Mm-hmm. Whiny and...
So, of course, Hoover's the perfect person to set all this up.
Who is?
Hoover.
Oh.
J. Edgar. Oh. I know he's up here.
Oh, sure. He got in the same way we did.
That's right. That's right. Through the back door.
That's right. But he's not over here.
What do you mean, not over here? He's up here.
No, I know. But well, he got himself into gay heaven, so...
What the hell is gay heaven?
Oh, it's a whole separate...
What do you mean? They got a ghetto up here?
Well,
see, that's where the Southerners were right. Alderman, you give them all that equality crap, and all they want to do is be off by themselves again the way we had it at the beginning.
Don't think it's a ghetto.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what they all...
But you haven't noticed how you don't see all that many gays in our neck of the...
Just assumed that they hadn't made the cut. You know, maybe all the preacher crap was true and all. You know, I mean, this much of it was true,
no,
so why?
No, they got their own place. I think it was Judy Garland pulled a lot of strings back when she first arrived.
Yeah. So we can't get in touch with Hoover. I mean, they don't have phone service or messenger angels or whatever the hell way they have to communicate with their agents around here.
No, of course, but he's unlisted, so...
Well, that's just fine. I mean, of course, that's his right to enjoy his privacy, although... I mean, once people know you're in gay heaven, you pretty much shot that wad. But
just not really likely that we're going to get him in time to...
Just thought of this.
Hmm?
Hoover wasn't Jewish, was he?
Oh, no.
Because I was just beginning to see a pattern, you know, where I protect him to the end, and of course, here he is, just refusing to get involved in the one way of dealing with the whole Henry problem.
Well, he's not refusing. He's...
Well, he's refusing to make himself available.
Yeah.
That's all refusing I need to hear.
Well,
as I say, that's his right,
mm-hmm.
You know. So, the thing to find out now is of the Cubans who are still alive.
Well, there's a couple I can...
Fine. Yeah, we got to find out if either of them knows any starlets.
All right, I'll...
Because, you know, otherwise...
No, obviously, that's key to this particular operation.
Yeah.
I get that.
I'll bet you Dean knows some starlets, you know, living in Brentwood or Westwood or some damn wood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, but he's not gonna...
No, of course not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about people that wouldn't take your call. So...
So I'll find out about the Cubans.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the starlets.
Yeah, and the starlets.
Okay.
When day is done and shadows fall, dream of you. When day is done, I think of all the joys we knew. That yearning, returning to hold you in my arms. Although I miss
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. A confidential planning document drawn up by British defense chiefs called Operation Tour Plot, parts of which have been disclosed to the London Sunday Telegraph, reveals that British troops will be serving on operations in Iraq and the Gulf until 2012 at least. British troops will remain for at least another 5 years, the government documents reveal. This appears to be in marked contrast to what Tony Blair said in February, giving the impression that British troops would remain in Iraq for less than 2 years. Senior commanders also revealed the number of troops committed to Afghanistan is likely to increase over the next 2 years. Thank God we're not British. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, it's time for the apologies of the week. As quickly as that. Yeah, there's some that are almost sorry, and then some that are. A mundane trip manifest of reporters who traveled to Latin America with President Bush has turned controversial because it included personal ID on the email sent to news bureaus. The key ingredients of identity theft, Social Security, and passport numbers were listed in the email. It's an identity theft waiting to happen. It's an honest mistake, said the president of the White House Correspondents Association. He apologized. Dateline Raleigh, North Carolina. The North Carolina Senate apologized this week for the legislature's role in promoting slavery and Jim Crow laws that denied basic human rights to the state's black citizens. Following the lead of lawmakers in Virginia, the Senate unanimously backed a resolution acknowledging its profound contrition. Ed Blakely is the recovery czar of New Orleans. During a speech in Sydney, Australia, he said he believed the pre-Katrina population of 455,000 residents estimated by the census was inflated. He said he thought only about 400,000. In a written statement, Blakely now says his comments about the pre-Katrina numbers were, quote, totally incorrect. It came from listening to a panel on population numbers that I attended prior to my appointment. I now understand that I was citing a speculation, not facts. I sincerely apologize for my error. Student journalist at St. Joseph University in Philadelphia publicly apologized for an April Fool's newspaper that compared Jesuits to Nazis. New York Daily News apologizes for saying he regrets his role in Postal Vid, implying that Richard Marino, the subject of a YouTube video, was sorry for an incident at a Brooklyn post office. Marino, in fact, is not sorry. The Daily News regrets the error. NPR is sorry. Quote, we aired a story about an off-duty Chicago police officer who beat up a female bartender. Because of our production error, the reporter seemed to say that police superintendent Phil Klein was not taking the incident seriously. In fact, Klein is very concerned, and we apologize to him and to the reporter. Walmart apologized Thursday for considering some shareholder groups as potential threats after they submitted proxy proposals ahead of the retailer's annual meeting. A Houston radio host and city councilman has apologized for saying taxpayers were paying large amounts of welfare to American Indians who were, quote, whining about having been whipped in a war. Michael Berry says he posted the apology on his station's website, not because I offended people, but because I was wrong. Presidential hopeful John McCain says he misspoke in comments he made about security in Baghdad and acknowledged that heavily armed troops and helicopter gunships accompanied him when he visited a market there. He had originally said it was cool to walk around in Baghdad now. And finally, maybe maybe the best apology this week.
Las palabras que elegí para expresarme no fueron las mejores. Y lo que quise decir es...
That's Newt Gingrich apologizing in a YouTube video for his recent remarks equating bilingual education with, quote, the language of living in a ghetto.
Para poder progresar y tener éxito.
Muy bien, Newtie. Apologizing in Spanish. That is so cute. So cute and so nude. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. Mistake free. That's right. All the mistakes are free. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, available at the mighty 104 in Berlin on Sirius and XM satellite radio networks around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like me slowing down if you'd agree to join me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh, Chicago, and San Diego desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.